All right, thanks to the organizers for inviting me. So Bill actually mentioned several of the things that, or some of the work that I'm going to be discussing in here, which is based on some of the simulations and work that Joel DeLean has done on energizing particles. So this is going to be, this talk will be a review of some of his work, and it's going to lead into what we've been doing since then to try to get at interesting questions for how electrons get energized and how it's possible to actually simulate this. So briefly, the motivation here, so this is actually not really astrophysical, but you could pretend for, the similar things will occur in your favorite astrophysical system. This is actually observations from the magnetotail. Again, these are electron energies. The point is that it's known that reconnection energizes electrons. That's what I'm going to be specifically talking about. There are in-situ observations of this happening in the magnetosphere. It's obviously, it happens in solar flares. It happens in many astrophysical systems. And so there's this question that you want to answer. So how does reconnection actually do this? How efficient is it? So if you're in different types of systems, how does that actually affect how the reconnection occurs? So that's sort of the general picture here. This is basically what I'm going to be arguing for much of this, for much of the talk. This bold thing is you can sort of go to lunch now if you really wanted to. So this is basically the peak non-relativistic electron acceleration requires Fermi acceleration and strong 3D transport. And Bill touched especially on this last one in his talk, and it is important. I should emphasize that I'm going to almost exclusively be discussing the non-relativistic case. Dmitry's going to be talking about relativistic later. There are also posters out there that also talk about it. And it turns out that there are very distinct differences between the two cases that weren't obvious when people really started into this work. So the guide field, it turns out it has two important roles. It controls the acceleration mechanism, and I'll go into this in a little bit more detail. There are two primary acceleration mechanisms. There's Fermi acceleration, which we've heard about a little bit already, and then just straight parallel electric field acceleration. It turns out that the guide field controls which of those two is dominant, and it turns out the other important thing is that the guide field is very important for 3D transport, as Bill mentioned, and I'll have some graphics that show that very clearly as well. So just as a brief introduction, in case you haven't seen this before, I'll do a little bit about the basic acceleration mechanisms that we want to consider. The first one is Fermi acceleration. So this dates back to, this is actually a figure from Fermi's paper in 1949. The basic idea is that if you have a bent field line, as you might see from reconnection, as we saw in Bill's talk just now, and you have a charged particle that comes along, it'll slingshot off of this, and you basically have a particle that's bouncing off a wall that's moving towards it, and it gains energy. This plot over here is actually a particle trace of a particle in a reconnecting system. This is position here. You don't see it, but there's an island, a magnetic island that is actually shrinking here. And this is the particle energy, and you can see that every time it bounces off the ends of the off the ends of the island, it gains energy. It's exactly this process. You bounce off the wall, you gain energy. So that's the first process. The second one is basically just E parallel. That's just an electric field parallel to the magnetic field. As you might expect, this is actually difficult to sustain on large scales because you get shorted, the electrons will tend to move along it and short it out. But it is a direct acceleration mechanism, and so we do have to consider it. And then another one, which has come up a few times during this talk, is betatron acceleration, which is basically conservation of the magnetic moment. This one changes V perp in contrast to the other two processes. Fermi and E parallel change the parallel component of the velocity. In reconnection, this turns out to not be particularly important. I'll show you an example of this. The basic reason is that in reconnection, in a bulk sense, the magnetic field strength is actually going down, which means V perp tends to go down, speaking very average-like. And that tends to mean that you're not going to get as much acceleration of particles. All right, so we can put this on a little bit of a more formal basis here. So if you go to the guiding center limit and you write down an equation that tells you how particles gain energy in bulk, you get something that looks like this. This is basically the particle energy here. And I've right now subdivided this into sort of three terms. The first one is basically the mathematical expression of Fermi reflection. So gamma is just, this is just the Lorentz gamma, mv parallel squared. UE is the E cross B drift. This is basically where the electric field enters, because of course we have to have the electric field to have particles gain energy. And kappa here is this expression, it's the magnetic field curvature. So this is basically saying that you need curved magnetic fields coupled into the E cross B drift, and you gain energy that way. This one is fairly simple. This is just parallel electric fields. And then this set down here is more or less Betatron acceleration. You can see that this thing out here looks a lot like mu. So we want to figure out how this works. So the basic idea, where did it go? Oh, it's behind here. All right, so we have a simulation of reconnection, and we can basically take that system, and I'll show it to you here. You're actually going to see two reconnecting layers there and there, and I'm going to show you what the Fermi term looks like during the system, as reconnection proceeds. So red means you're gaining energy, blue means you're losing energy, and you can see that you get multiple islands that form, they merge together. I'll play that again one more time. What you'll generally see for this sort of thing is that you have these outflows where you get, in general, sort of red kind of behavior. That means that the particles are gaining energy. There are mixtures in here of blue, which is a slightly complicated thing because things are sloshing back and forth. But on net, you actually do gain energy. The point of these things is, though, we can take these systems, we can take these simulations, and we can evaluate each of those terms in the previous, that I had in the previous slide. And you get something kind of ugly that looks like this. So this is for a system with a guide field of 1. This is basically the rate of energy gain on this axis. This is versus time. And all of these squiggles are different terms. The ones you want to look at, there's this red curve here, which is bumpy. But this is integrated over the entire box. That's the Fermi term. E parallel is the blue. And then the Betatron term, which is this magenta sort of thing, which is around near zero. And then the fact that the black lines, the dash and the dot, are kind of near each other is just confirmation that the right-hand side and the left-hand side of the equation balances. So this is the kind of thing we work with in these simulations. We, as a function of time, we can evaluate each of the terms, and then we can see which ones in net are more important. So what does this look like sort of spatially? So again, this is what I just showed was a 2D system, just for simplicity, to isolate the mechanisms. Fermi reflection sort of looks like this. This is, you can think of this as a snapshot from the system that I showed earlier. Red is energy gain, and that tends to happen over here where the field lines are curved, as you might expect from the slingshot. It tends to be volume filling. It's almost all red here. Typically, you do have some blue that's elsewhere, but on the most part, it's positive. And the energy scaling is fairly strong. It's proportional to the energy. Basically, the rich get richer in Fermi acceleration. In E parallel, by contrast, it's a different story. You can see here you've got splotches of red and blue next to each other. Note the scale. These reds are actually stronger than these reds, but they're also balanced by blues that are also just as strong. In net, there is average acceleration here. But almost all of it occurs in this sort of green region right here in the center, where the you have basically the reconnection electric field. If you look over here and you sort of average over this, you have in net pretty much no acceleration. And this has relatively weak energy scaling. It goes as the square root of the energy. All right, so what we find then is that the difference in those two energization mechanisms, one that the Fermi that goes is proportional to E, or epsilon, and the E parallel is proportional to E, the square root of epsilon, it shows you that for the more energetic particles, that's what's plotted over here, more energetic over here, Fermi is basically more important. So E parallel scales weakly, Fermi scales more strongly. That means that Fermi, if you're Fermi dominated, you're going to get more energization. Fermi turns out to be more important for the more energetic particles.
What is what?
Sorry, this is the energy gain rate here, sort of arbitrary units. You can think of this as, this is averaged over the box. Averaged over the box, and then this is, you could think of this as the energy of the particle. So you take the average over the box, you take a distribution function of your particles, you figure out the energy, the rate of energy gain as a function of energy. Okay, so where does the guide field fill into this? It turns out that the guide field determines whether or not Fermi or E parallel wins. The basic idea is that plotted up here. This is sort of the 3D picture where your guide field is up. This is your reach and action plane. When you have bent field lines, you get a strong kick when the curvature is strongest. So when you have head-on reflections, when you have a particle that comes in and bounces off, you get the head-on reflection is a strong kick. When you add a guide field, though, basically all of these field lines get stretched. They get a strong component in this direction, and that naturally ends up reducing the curvature. Basically, you go from something like this to something that has a strong component up here. You have only a glancing reflection, and you have a relatively weak kick that occurs. So the guide field, if it's sufficiently strong, basically just kills Fermi. E-parallel is not really affected by this, and so the guide field determines whether or not Fermi wins or not. So that's what's being shown here. This is as a function of guide field down here, and this is basically fraction of energy gain. So you can think of this as, for the total energy gain of the system, which one wins? Is it Fermi or is it E-parallel? For small guide field, Fermi dominates, and then for large guide field, you get this large, E-parallel actually wins. Okay, but it turns out there's a little bit of a twist to this. It turns out that E-parallel, even though it wins for high guide field, does a really poor job of, it's very inefficient at accelerating electrons. So what's being shown here is basically the fraction of particles that are accelerated by E-parallel as a function of basically how many energized electrons there are. And these are for different guide fields. So for large guide fields up here, E-parallel is accelerating most of the particles, but it's not accelerating very many of them. Whereas for smaller guide fields, E-parallel is not doing very much, but there are a lot of particles that are being accelerated. So if you want E-parallel to win, you can go to large guide field, but unfortunately it's not going to do very much for you. Whereas at smaller guide field, Fermi will actually win and it will do most of the acceleration. Okay, so that was the first topic. The second one is basically something that Bill talked about, which is all of what I had shown you before was in 2D. It turns out that 3D adds a very interesting wrinkle in here that makes energization of particles much more efficient. So what's being plotted here is basically a distribution function as a function of particle energy from a particular system, which has been run in both 2D and 3D. Black is sort of your initial particle, your initial distribution. Red is what happens in 2D. Is dying, and then green is what happens in 3D. And you can see that, especially at the larger energies, there's order of magnitude, several orders of magnitude of increase of energetic particles. So why does this actually happen? This is fairly robust. This is a robust result. And the result is basically something that Bill referred to in his talk. It's that in 2D, you have these islands that form, and these islands are basically closed systems where energetic particles get into, but they can't get out. So that's what's being shown on the bottom down here. This is the energy density of energetic particles, and you can see that all the energetic particles are trapped inside of the reconnecting islands. The Fermi reflection term is only strong at the very ends of the islands. Basically, you get sort of one shot in 2D with energetic particles. They get accelerated once, they get stuck in the islands, and then they don't go anywhere. In 3D, it's very different. Here is the energetic particle distribution in 3D, and you can see that there are particles all over the place. And the Fermi reflection term is also large all over the place. So why does this actually happen? Well, it turns out that chaotic field lines are basically the key. So the thing that's shown in the top left there is what happens in 2D. The base plot is what I just showed you in that previous one. It's energetic particles. And then blue are magnetic field lines. And so in 2D, you get this structure that looks absolutely gorgeous. I mean, you've got nice spiraling field lines, completely unrealistic. But basically, energetic particles just get stuck there. They just get stuck in the magnetic field. They spiral along. They don't go anywhere. In 3D, you get that mess in the bottom left-hand corner. Those are magnetic field lines. Particles are free to go pretty much anywhere. They can sample one energization site, one site of Fermi reflection, scatter all, or go on a field line, end up in another one, they get multiple reflections, and so they gain energy. They have the ability to gain energy nearly continuously. So the bottom left is actually much more realistic. It's what's seen in simulations. The top left, while seen in simulations, it's not particularly realistic. You never see anything like that in the data. So the guide field, it turns out, controls the 3D transport, as I said. or the guide field actually turns out controls the 3D transport. So if you have no guide field, the system behaves quasi-2D-ish. That's what's shown in the top right there. The magnetic field lines are not particularly stretched in the upward direction. So the field lines sort of sit around here, and you get a little bit, you get quasi-2D fields, sort of island trapping, at least to an extent. In 3D, when you have a large guide field, you get much more of this sort of stochastic field lines. You get stronger transport. And that's what's being shown over here. Again, these are just, the x-axis is energy. The y-axis is the ratio, or the increase in 3D with respect to 2D. And you can see that the green is for larger guide field. You get more of an increase with the larger guide field of 3D over 2D. All right, so the guide field controls the 3D transport. The guide field also makes Fermi acceleration more efficient. And so you have these two competing requirements. Efficient Fermi requires the guide field to be sort of less than one. 3D transport requires the guide field to be large-ish. And so if you turns out that if you plot as a function of guide field the number of energetic electrons, you get this peak that is somewhere around about a half to one. Basically, what this says is that if you have a guide field of one is what you need for more or less the peak electron energization. All right, so what I haven't mentioned so far are power laws. So when I started at the beginning of the talk, I showed these observations for the magnetotail. They were for what you had there were energetic electrons that were formed a power law. You see power laws in the solar corona whenever they're associated with flares. What I have plotted here looks like a power law, but actually isn't a power law. And the reason being that the x-axis is not a log scale. This is actually an exponential distribution. The reason I've done this is because it turns out it's very difficult in non-relativistic reconnection to get power laws. If you go to these posters that I've referenced to at the bottom or that listen to Dimitri's talk, you'll find out that in the relativistic case, it's much, much easier. Pretty much every simulation that has done relativistic reconnection can get power laws. The non-relativistic case, it's much harder. In the systems that Joel looked at, he did not see them very frequently. There is a poster out there, Zhao Han, which talks about the possibility that if you go to low enough beta, that's the key that you may be able to get power laws there. And that may be consistent with what are seen in some of the observations. So the magnetotail result that I showed at the very beginning was in a relatively low beta system. So this is still a little bit of an open question as to why power laws do not appear in the simulations. Nature is unfortunately not being confirmed by the simulations very well because the power laws appear there pretty much whenever anyone looks at them. But they don't show up in the simulations consistently yet, and it's still an open question as to exactly why that is. But there has been substantial work and people are interested in this. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about in the few minutes I have left is basically what do we do with this information? So we have this idea that we think we know how electrons are being energized, and it turns out the answer, broadly speaking, is Fermi acceleration. What's interesting about this is that it is not something that actually relies on the details of these kinetic layers of reconnection. So Bill showed that you typically get where you actually break the frozen in constraints at these very tiny layers. To get that right, the typical idea is that you need to include some sort of kinetic scale physics in your simulation. But the nice thing about this Fermi acceleration is that it actually doesn't depend on that. So the Fermi acceleration is, broadly speaking, happens in the outflow, and it doesn't really matter what happens in the thought is that it doesn't matter what happens in the very small layer where E parallel might matter, but the Fermi term is actually pretty much negligible. So what we want to do with this is we can actually now use this because looking at doing PIC simulations or kinetic simulations of these very large scale systems are impossible in any foreseeable future. And so the question is, can we actually look at particle energization, do an end run around the problem, look at particle energization, but not actually get the details of the reconnection correct? the conclusion that we, or the thought that we have here, is that this Fermi, the fact that Fermi acceleration is the major term, means that we might actually be able to do it. So here's the idea. If E parallel is unimportant, we can actually ignore the physics behind it. So we can basically just eliminate the kinetic scales and do construct a new kind of model based on this physics. Basically, we take a sort of self-consistent MHD backbone, and then we add in an energetic component of particles that are propagated on top of that. These energetic particles, they take into account things like pressure anisotropy, and they have feedback on the NHD fluid through the currents that they generate. So we can show, you can write down a system of equations of this. You can show that the total energy is conserved. Jim Drake's poster, which is out there, has much more detail about this. So you can go look at it. I'll just highlight a couple of things. These are sort of the equations that get used. I won't go through them in any detail. I'll note that we do have to include, though, sort of a large-scale E parallel. This is work. This is based on this idea of Jan Egdahl that he's been promoting for a while. It turns out that that happens to be important. You can include that in a self-consistent way that conserves energy. You also need to take care of the electron anisotropy. So the basis for this, these are simulations of reconnection again. Remember I said at the beginning that Fermi and E parallel tend to increase the V parallel, sorry, Fermi and the electric field tend to increase V parallel, or the parallel component of velocity. That's basically what you're seeing here. This is parallel, this is perp. Momentum in this case for 2D and 3D, and you can see that the parallel, that you get these large anisotropies, that parallel, T parallel or P parallel, however you want to think of it, is much larger, and then that can end up driving things like fire hose, which then shut off your reconnection. So you have to have, it's very important that you have this anisotropy in there, because otherwise you will end up getting this sort of runaway and you won't get the feedback on the reconnection correctly. So this new model that I've talked about, we've gone through various code validation. I'll only talk about one of them here. There's several more that are mentioned in the poster. Basically, one thing you can look at is, do you get the parallel, do you get an Alfvén wave correct when you add in P parallel and P perp are different from each other? All that's being plotted here is, this is the phase speed of the Alfvén wave versus this anisotropy parameter. The line is a, basically the linear fit is the linear theory. The stars are what you get from the simulation. It does very well. You can look further on this with fire hose. You can do more sophisticated things. We're in the process of basically running through this, and we're currently actually doing our first simulations of reconnection and still working out the bugs. They're not there yet, but hopefully that will be showing up soon. All right, I have a couple minutes left. Let me just mention my conclusions. So basically, peak electron acceleration requires the Fermi acceleration, and it requires these, if you want to get it right, you have to do it 3D, because the 3D transport turns out to be absolutely crucial. So the guide field controls the mechanism. If you get large enough guide field, it just shuts off Fermi, but it also controls the 3D transport, so you do want some guide field, but basically not a lot of guide field. And then we can put these together into a computational model based on this work that basically self-consistently describes all this, and we're hoping will enable us to look at this problem of acceleration without having to get the kinetic details of the reconnection correct. So I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. So Mark gave us an extra 5 minutes, so we've got plenty of time for questions. And so I'll start.
Thank you. Hi. I just had a quick question. That plot you showed with the multiple Fermi cycles,
yep.
You don't need to go back to it. It's fine. Yeah. That was that or was that not from a simulation of non-relativistic reconnection?
This was from non-relativistic reconnection.
It is. So that's a particle track from one of the simulations you show.
I won't say it's from one of the simulations I actually showed, but it's from a simulation like one of the simulations I showed.
Because it's kind of hard to reconcile this and the fact you don't get a power law, I guess. You see what I'm saying? If it's under, or no, is that not true? If you undergo many cycles of Fermi acceleration, shouldn't you form a power law?
You need the state mechanism too.
Okay. So it's true. So maybe I'm
misunderstanding.
So one of the issues for getting a power law is that, as Ellen said, you historically, the thought is that you need some sort of escape mechanism. So the way that Fermi just derived it back, I think in this paper actually, is that you write down sort of the equation governing it, and you have an escape mechanism, and that's how you end up getting a power law. In the systems that we have right now, they're periodic, and so particles don't have a natural escape mechanism. I will say, and Fawn's getting the microphone right now, so he has opinions about whether or not what the escape mechanism can be, or whether or not it can actually, you can have sort of one embedded into a periodic system by having escape from your layer count as an escape mechanism.
Okay.
So in the last part of the talk, you mentioned this feedback and self-consistency within particles and the MHD system, essentially. So the question is, you can imagine that if you accelerate particles a lot, these particles will back react on the dynamics of reconnection, maybe slowing down reconnection, and so on and so forth. So do you reach in these calculations a kind of asymptotic or quasi-stationary spectrum in the acceleration, or you are far from this condition?
So you can. So this was referred to.
And if you can, what kind of spectrum you generate?
So if you look, so there are a couple different answers to your question, which is probably not completely satisfying. So if you do systems like this, the system does stop at some point because it sort of saturates. You run out of room, actually. The system sort of stops reconnecting. Having said that, you can do systems, if you start your system with a high enough beta, what will happen is the reconnection will start, and then, as was alluded to yesterday, you can actually hit fire hose, and it basically just shuts off. The system just stops reconnecting, pretty much. And so then you get your spectrum comes up a little bit, and then it just kind of doesn't grow anymore. So beta turns out to be very important as to whether or not you hit this sort of fire hose boundary that will stop things. I think you could imagine that if you went to larger and larger systems, at the very minimum, this is going to extend out to higher and higher energies. We seem to think that the power law, we don't have power laws yet, but the reconnection power, when people do systems in relativistic reconnection, they do converge to sort of a power law with a constant slope, and then it just sort of fills out the tail.
So I have two comments. First comment should be easier. So we also looked at the coupling between three-dimensional effect and guide field, but I mean, the dependence we get is actually even in three-dimensional simulations, it is still stronger in the weak guide field limit compared to the guide field one-ish. I think the reason may be because when you study this, you are looking at the difference between 3D and 2D, and that tend to show the guide field one gives you the strongest effect, but the Fermi acceleration is strongest at the weak guide field. Actually, Xiaochan has done two 3D simulations with low beta condition, and the guide field 0.2 case actually give a power law, but the guide field 1 case did not give us a power law. So that's something I think useful to clarify if you can comment on that. I have a second comment.
Part do you want me to comment on? The beta dependence or the...
The guide field dependence for 3D.
So I'm not quite sure I'm following your point as to why comparison of 3D over 2D actually is a misleading way of looking at it.
It seems like our analysis still shows even in 3D, the guide field zero case still give you a stronger acceleration than the intermediate guide field case.
Questioning whether the peak is a half or 0.2.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between, okay, so the fact that, yes, there's a peak here at 0.5. Now, if you force me to say absolutely, I don't know, sell my children as to whether or not it's 0.2 versus 0.5, I wouldn't be able to do that.
Let me go to my second.
Except on that they're on their bad days, maybe.
So my second comment will be maybe more disorganized. So we looked at the power law issue. I think I might just maybe say a few words. So there is a very very interesting paper by Luke Dury, although that might be not the most classical paper he wrote, but You see, in 1999, he had a paper, actually, you have a solution for forming the parallel distribution from whatever distribution you can have. And it actually, you can solve that equation and sort of match each term in peak simulation and try to study the time evolution of the parallel distribution. And in our reconnection paper, we sort of have a simplified version that sort of try to illuminate the idea. And there are a few things we think are very important. One is the acceleration and the duration of acceleration. To simplify that, it's just a production of acceleration rate and times the acceleration time need to be strong enough. Then you can have extended formation of parallel. That also opens a window in the energy distribution, so you can have a parallel distribution. And another thing that may be also interesting is if you look at the Fermi's formula, that you have the spectrum slope dependent on the acceleration rate and the effective escape time. So that tells you if you have a 2 weeks of acceleration, your slope will be very soft, that you may not see a parallel at all. And the final thing I want to, I just never see a paper that tells me what's the effect of escape on the formation of parallel. So if you look at Fermi's original paper, he just said the slope depends on escape, but he did not say the formation of slope depends on escape. I failed to see any papers talk about that. So I want to talk to Alan about why you have to have escape for the formation of parallel, because I never see that in any papers.
I wasn't sure if the speaker was asked to respond to that.
I did have... there was a lot to digest there. So the question of whether of what to use for an escape time is a little bit of a tricky one. I agree with you. I mean, strictly speaking, in our system, of course, it's fully periodic, so there's not really an escape mechanism. But I know that you've argued, or you've been on papers that argued that, all right, perhaps the relevant issue is particles that are able to escape from the region where they're basically being accelerated. Maybe that is based what you should be using for the escape time. I guess what would be nice to see is basically some way of being able to twiddle that parameter to somehow affect the escape time to see if that actually changes the power law that you end up getting. I haven't seen anything that does that. To address the final point that you made, I also don't know exactly anything that talks about the formation of the power law sort of from ab initio. I guess one could consider seeding this thing with the power law and seeing what happens. Maybe that would be interesting. We haven't tried that yet.
I have a question for you about an alternative model for Fermi acceleration. I believe I heard Jan Egedal talk about this a few years ago, where it's a first-order mechanism where you use that Fermi acceleration mechanism you were describing, sort of slingshotting about this moving bend in the field that's moving away from the reconnection site, and then the particles are reflected back towards the reconnection site by an electrostatic potential. Is that something that you've ever seen, or is that something that has been now ruled out?
Yes and no. So yes, that tends to happen. So this large-scale parallel electric field that I talked about at the beginning, I talked about at the end, is basically the E parallel that Jan's talking about. So you can get it's a little hard to see here, but if you sort of integrate over this, there's actually an E parallel, a large-scale E parallel that develops here. It can sort of reflect particles, and they can bounce back and forth through here, as opposed to sort of the Fermi, the one picture of the Fermi is where the thing sort of is doing something like that. It is true that both of them can exist. If particles get energetic enough, they barrel all the way through the E parallel and come back around. But if they're sufficiently low energy, then they can actually do this sort of bouncing thing over here. Both of them are Siemens simulations. Yeah, Colby Haggerty is over there.
I actually have the mic.
Oh, he has the mic. He can talk about this too.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. You have to wait in time.
I actually had a different question. Did he answer? Or? Okay, then we could also talk about more. Yeah, so we saw the potential when we were doing electron and ion heating stuff, and what we largely found was that the potential really only pre-accelerates electrons. It can't really, because it's a well, anything it gets from it, it loses from it, but what we found was as it was pre-accelerated, it enhanced kind of the Fermi acceleration process. So important in the process, but not the final accelerator.
All right, so just a general comment, and I said this before, and I, as you saw, word Fermi acceleration triggers certain emotions in astrophysicists. And whenever you say Fermi acceleration, people imagine power laws right away. And in this case, it is a Fermi acceleration in the sense that it gives energy, but that's because there are converging walls. In the same way, a compressing balloon of gas is imparting energy to the gas inside, and the temperature of the gas will increase. It doesn't mean that it will become a power law. Whatever you put into this balloon and you compress it, its energy will increase, right? So it is an energy gain mechanism, and it is formally a Fermi acceleration, but if you use Fermi acceleration in an astrophysical audience, you will get the response that Patrick just produced. people will ask, where are your power laws? So on that, in that regard, let me circle back to this parallel electric field again. I know it's sort of a recurring discussion in all of these meetings. What beta did you use in these simulations?
Beta based on the reconnecting electric field or total based on the guide field? Based on the reconnecting magnetic field, beta is sort of one-ish. If you have the guide field, if you add the guide field into the total B, it drops beta down.
So the empirical evidence from non-relativistic simulations that have been, I think in some of the posters outside and other simulations, is that at lower betas, people start seeing power laws. There is still no escape. Particles are still stuck in the islands. The same Fermi acceleration, as you phrase it, is still there, yet power laws seem to appear. So I think there is an empirical evidence that there is something about low beta that makes this possible. And I think what does it is the fact that particles at lower beta, especially electrons, don't miss X points as easily. So when they have large velocity, large beta, they can easily swing past the X point and not actually get electric field from the X point. Just go straight into the island, get compressed, get their Maxwellians. But if they are colder and they can pass through the X point, experience E-parallel. While they don't get all of their energy from that E-parallel, they do start getting a power law. And I think this is the thing we're seeing in the relativistic reconnection as well. The most energetic particles that do end up in the power law do pass through the X points. So while it is true that most of the energy is not coming from the parallel, it is that X point that seeds the power law. That's my impression based from the relativistic things, and now extrapolating to low beta non-relativistic things. So I'm wondering, what do you see in this case?
So there is a secondary issue here that might bear on this beta question in particular. So when we're trying to look for power laws, we're trying to pull one out of the initial distribution function. So naturally, if you're on low beta and this distribution function sort of collapsed down in this direction, it's easier to pull out a power law than it would be in the higher beta system. It may be the case that one could imagine it's the case that maybe it's just that we haven't done a sufficiently large enough system and let it run long enough to actually get particles that get pulled out to be a convincing enough power law that someone will actually believe it. So it could be that this issue of power law is that there is no actual difference here between these different systems. It's just a matter of how long they're running them.
By itself will not give you a power law.
True.
You need to seed it with something. And what else can it be other than a parallel?
So I agree. So yes, you need to seed it with something. E-parallel, the E-parallel that Colby was talking about, you need some sort of process that will seed it. Okay, but then you want to actually get it up to sufficiently high enough energy so that you actually get something non-thermal.
There was another mic. Oh,
So I was a little interested in some of the details about the new proposed set of simulation code you're running. Mm-hmm. Is it like a Lagrangian or an Eulerian approach? Are you tracking like grid cells, or is there some kind of like high energy particle type thing? And if it's one versus the other, is there a way you handle of how you promote stuff from like thermal energies to higher energies? Or
so it's grid cells. So you basically just sort of are running. Trying to decide, since you know P3D, I could talk to you in that language, but sort of more generally, quantities are defined on grid cells, and then you've got particles that are sort of floating over on top of that that evolve in those fields, and then those, you take the moments of those particles to evaluate things like the pressure tensor, and then those feed back into the equations.
So do you have a mechanism for promoting from the, oh wait, never mind, I think I understood, thank you.
Okay.
Mark. I have a simple question. This nice model that you presented near the end of your talk, what is the difference between that and Karlsrud's kinetic MHD model?
So there, it's very similar. It turns out to be very similar. So I don't remember. So do you actually talk about this on the poster in any detail or not, Jim? I can't remember.
No.
Seems like a special case of Karlsrud then, does it?
In some sense.
Yeah.
But it's actually not written here, but the paraelectric field we have is not quite the same as what Karlsrud had. But I'm happy to talk to you.
Sure. I'll come by your poster.
I don't have the equation. Yeah, I didn't include the equation for E parallel up here. It's on the poster, though.
Okay.
So, yeah, I guess a comment about the power of business. So Anatoly talked about a low beta is favorable to get the power low. And in fact, if you inject a pointing flux from outside, driven reconnection case, we have a tendency to get a power low spectrum. So I think if you are going to the low beta, that means the background plasma density is zero outside. Then you can get a very fast reconnection and get a large electric field, and that has a chance to get a power low. That's my feeling from my simulations.
Yeah, I can see that.
Okay, Bill, do you want to ask
a couple of comments just on the issue of the power law? That it's not true that you're accelerating all the particles simultaneously like you showed. That's only a subset, and that subset is changing in time, because you have an upstream region that's being injected. So when you account for this time evolution of the injection, some particles have a chance to be accelerated much longer. And it's this effect that will naturally give you a power law. So if we go to low beta, I mean, you will see them if you run long enough.
Right.
How long can you get a superpositional Maxwellian?
What's that?
You could get the superpositional Maxwellian.
It's essentially the opposite effect, right? It's, yeah.
Well, power law is not a superpositional Maxwellian. What
but sure, you can do it. I mean, over some range, you can do it as a superposition of Maxwellian.
Right, but in reality, is it or is it?
Well, that's another question. I mean, the other comment is that if the detailed E-parallel doesn't matter to the acceleration, at least it's not dominant, I think we agree with you, but it may change the reconnection dynamics itself, right? That if whether it's more Petchek-like or plasmoid-dominated, if it's plasmoid-dominated, there may be little E-parallels all over the place, but those little E-parallels are what's giving you that dynamics. And then, so indirectly, the flows and perturbations may care about all these little E-parallels.
Right? That's so definitely true, yeah.
Very tricky.
Yeah, it's tricky. Okay, let's see, how are we doing?
It's lunchtime.
We have 28 seconds.
Okay, I can make a very short comment.
Very short.
So I have two things. One is we think a low beta. Low beta just get a power law. Just like I said, just have a stronger acceleration. I think we think that's the key. And another thing, both Lorenzo and Zeroni and I confirmed, even if you only keep perpendicular electric field, you still can't get the power law in the relativistic case.
Okay.
Okay, I guess everybody can see the whole issue of when and why you get parallel power laws in reconnection is really important. And I think it's still important even for the relativistic case. What are those power laws? So this is a good thing.
There's more after lunch, so you can come back and fight more then. I don't know how to go back there.